timer too. That's well, good evening once again. It is good to be here for Bible study. We are covering Genesis chapters 4 through 9. I should have asked, does anybody need copies of the study questions this evening? Everybody have? Okay, here. Anybody? Getting into this section of Genesis 4 through 9, 4, 5, and 6 gives us the history of the pre-flood world and the events that are there, really 1600 years, is summarized in these three chapters. And then by the time we get on into 7, 8, and 9, the focus is on the flood. It's on God's intervention. God gives us an overview in some of this section of Genesis as to the way this world's civilization and society began. Now, Genesis chapter 4 picks up the story after Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden. Adam knew Eve, his wife. She conceived and bore Cain and said, "I have gotten a man from the eternal," as is translated in the King James. Others may vary slightly. The actual literal rendering is, "I have gotten a man, the eternal." And most of the translators considered the "from" as understood, though there is another possibility, as we will take note of. She again bore his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. Now, in most cases, we find a formula like we have in Genesis 4:1. Adam knew Eve, his wife. She conceived and bore Cain. With Abel, it does not say that. The literal Hebrew is, "she added in bearing his brother Abel." A Jewish tradition holds that Cain and Abel were twins. The text doesn't necessarily prove that, but it is certainly an implication in the way that it's worded. It's a little different than what maybe the standard formula is. We find, though, that twins or not, they certainly were of totally different character, and they pursued different lives. Now, in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Eternal. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, very upset. His countenance fell. And God said, "Why are you upset? Why are you wroth? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, shall you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door. Unto you shall be its desire." You know, but you shall rule over him. The point is that sin is waiting for you, Cain. Sin is lying at the door, and sin is going to pull you down. You've got to master it. You've got to overcome it. Now, what we find, a couple of things that we ought to take note of. Cain did not bring for one thing, we notice here that God had respect to Abel and his offering and not unto Cain. Now, what was the difference? Well, clearly, part of it was that Abel brought a sin offering. Abel recognized himself as a sinner. He brought of the firstlings of the flock. And Cain, we're told, simply brought of the fruit of the ground. We're not even told that he brought the first fruits or the best, but he brought of the fruit of the ground. He brought a thank offering. Abel also brought of the first. The implication is Abel brought a thank offering, but in addition to that, he brought a sin offering. Abel provided an offering, produced an offering that acknowledged his consciousness that he was a sinner in need of a Savior. Cain did not indicate that by what he offered. The shedding of blood was something that was tied in with the sin offering, going back to what we had talked about in Genesis 3 last time, when God slew the first animal there to in the aftermath of Cain and or of Adam and Eve's sin. Now, what we find is that Cain had a bad attitude, and when he got correction, his attitude got worse. You see, God did not accept Cain's offering in the way that he accepted Abel's offering. And I think clearly it has to get back to attitude. It gets back to the fact that Cain did not acknowledge himself as a sinner. And when God talked to him, Cain just got mad. See, God warned him. He said, "You're on the verge of something terrible. Sin lies at the door. You've got to overcome it. You've got to master it." Well, a little bit later, Cain talked with Abel, his brother. When they were in the field, Cain arose and slew him. So Cain blamed Abel for his problems, which is a carnal way of looking at things, you see. Somebody else's fault. So God said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And he said, "Well, how do I know? You know, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Well, at that point, it became obvious that, you know, what Cain's response was going to be. And so God said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries unto me from the ground. You are cursed from the earth, which has opened her mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto you her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shall you be in the earth." Now notice Cain's response. He said unto the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Oh, woe is me. You are picking on me. Life is so unfair. Oh, no. My punishment is greater than I can bear." Now, he just got through killing his brother. Just got through murdering his brother, and God says, "I'm going to exile you. You're going to be a vagabond." And Cain says, "Oh, no. Life is so unfair. You've driven me forth this day from the face of the earth, and from your face shall I be hid. I'll be a fugitive and a vagabond, and it'll come to pass that everyone that finds me shall slay me." No, only the first one. You know, the others won't need to, will they? You sort of get the idea that Cain was just really bogged down in self-pity. Oh, he just... it's very apparent. Cain's whole focus in life centered around himself. He was a very self-centered individual. And I'm sure some of that goes back. You know, Eve had been told that that there would come... God told her in the aftermath of the sin of Adam and Eve, and at the time of their expulsion from the garden, God told her that there would come the seed of woman who would bruise the head of the serpent. Now, he didn't tell her how long. Didn't tell her which woman. It's not inconceivable that Eve sort of fancied that her first son was perhaps that promised seed. Cain certainly grew up viewing himself as one that did not need to offer a sin offering, one that was... well, as we're going to see, one that whose life really centered around himself. Now, there we find that God, it was not God's purpose to have Cain executed, that God could have done that, but it was not God's purpose at that time. God was allowing the lesson or the record of human experience to be written. And what are the consequences of the kind of life that Cain was living? What would be the results? What are the results when violence, when a person is violent? God allowed that record to be written in the pre-flood world, and the record, of course, was that violence begets violence. By the time of Genesis chapter 6, we come to the point that violence filled the earth, starting with Cain and his family. Now, God exiled Cain, and he set a mark, and people have puzzled over the mark. the mark of Cain. God set a mark upon Cain, we're told, lest any finding him should kill him. Now, let's talk about that a little bit. The word mark, translated mark here, the Hebrew word is alph, O-W-T-H, and it means a sign, a mark, a signal, a beacon, a flag, an ensign. It you know, all of those words are terms by which that word is translated, depending on context, somewhere in the Old Testament. The point is that it was something that was there as a sign or as a marker. It was to signify something. It was to identify. It was something to identify Cain. Now God was exiling Cain from the land of Eden, as we're told in verse 16, to go to the land of Nod, which was on the east of Eden. Land of Nod means the land of wandering. The human family, of course, had not spread out very much. We're at a point, perhaps only maybe 25 years or so from creation at the point that this occurs. Yes.
I have a question about that, because it says that when Eve buried, God has appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew.
That's right. Your implication is that Seth was the next one she had. Is that what you're getting?
Well, it just seems that the two events, the death of Abel and the birth of Seth, must have been reasonably close together.
Well, I see where you're getting that. I don't necessarily draw the same conclusion, in the sense that I think, as you read the story here of Cain and what transpired, I think clearly Seth was the replacement for Abel. But you know, Cain was there had been a number of other children born during this time, because Cain was married when he was exiled. I would say that if Abel was married, he certainly had no children by that time. And Cain had no children either. The indication is his first son was born a little while later. I think one of the things we get into is the matter of how quickly the let's say things the population grew. I don't think God's purpose was to fill the earth within a relatively short period of time. You know, we really can't prove the exact time setting here. I think, based on the other things, in terms of even the age when most of the other patriarchs had their children, I find it difficult that there would have been no Adam and Eve would have had no grandchildren for, you know, let's say 100 or 120 years into the story. There's no particular proof in exactly how long they were married before Cain and Abel were born. My thought on it is that it was probably fairly soon. We know that the first clear date we have is Genesis 5, verse 3, that Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own image, and his own likeness after his image, and called his name Seth. We find that, of course, up in the end of chapter 4, that where we're told that Seth was born, and that Eve said, "He has appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew." One thing about it, I think clearly Seth and Abel were of the same appearance. You know, one implication from going back to Deuteronomy is that God separated the sons of Adam. I think that the various racial groupings actually sprang from the children of Adam. You know, they're certainly not the product of evolution. They are a matter, you know, the Bible doesn't tell us exactly, but I think the implication is that there were things that were there, and that was a part of the pre-flood world. And we know just from a, let's say, a biological standpoint that when a little girl, when a little infant girl is born, that every egg cell that she will have during her lifetime is already present in microscopic or submicroscopic size, actually in her body. That contains the imprint of her heredity, that you know, what of the heredity of her forebearers, of what, you know, she will pass on to any future offspring. Well, in Eve's case, she was created mature. She was created as a mature adult woman, and she had no heredity in terms of, you know, parents, grandparents, anything of that sort. So whatever God programmed into each of those little egg cells in terms of, you know, whatever the genetic material that was there and the material that would be Eve's contribution to her to determining the genetic makeup of her offspring, God had to program that in. And I can't prove that. My opinion on it is that that is the point in which God programmed in what would give rise to the various racial groupings, when we ethnic groupings. We find, and part of that I base on the statement back in back in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8. It says, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when He separated the sons of Adam, He set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Now, God had the children of Israel in mind way before Jacob ever had 12 sons. God purposed the various groupings and where they would be, and with the intent in mind of where the children of Israel would ultimately be. And He had that all purposed from the beginning. But it talks about Him separating the sons of Adam. And I think that, God had to do it that way, or He had to supernaturally intervene at some later generation and do something. In terms of the mark here, again, it's speculative. The Bible doesn't tell us exactly what it was. I think we see that it was some sort of a marker, some sort of a sign that God established. I would, again, my opinion on it is that it was initially established as something that was established as like a boundary marker to mark the demarcation line between the area of the family of Cain, which was in the land of Nod, the land east of Eden, the land of wandering, and sort of the point beyond which people should not go. One way or the other. It's interesting, and if you were to look, you know, if God had established or set up some sort of a boundary marker, it's not unlikely that perhaps Cain would have worn, would have taken to actually wearing a small, a copy, a model of it, something that was he could wear. One thing that has struck me as interesting: there is a universal religious symbol. I say universal in the sense that it has played a major role in virtually all of the pagan cultures. You find it in Asia. You find it in Europe. You can find it even among the Indians of Central America. And that particular religious emblem is the cross. If you want to look in Egypt, If you want to look at various places, they used slightly different forms, but that was the insignia. You know, if you were going to set up a boundary marker, to have initially you know, set up some sort of a post with a cross piece on it as a you know, as like a boundary marker or something, it's not unlikely that something like that would have been viewed by later generations as sort of like a good luck charm and have come to be used. I think that we're looking, well, along that line, back several years ago, I guess this would have been back around 93. I think it was the spring of 1993. There came out an article in the Worldwide News, that, you know, use of the cross was fine and the use of wearing crosses and things of that sort. One of the things that I thought was interesting in terms of their timing was at the same time I got that that particular statement, issue of Biblical Archaeology Review arrived within a few days of that, and they had a very interesting article and picture. Very interesting picture in Biblical Archaeology Review. There had been an excavation in the area of Samaria, and from time to time they unearth something that has the name of a biblical character, and that's always interesting because you figure, you know, of all the thousands of people up there, you know, find somebody who's mentioned in the Bible. But this was quite a significant find. It was a royal seal that would have been used to seal documents, and it was the seal of Jezebel. Had her name on it, and it was the royal seal, and the thing that was interesting, they reproduced a picture of it there, and then they had sort of a drawn version of it. The focal point, there were several insignias on it. The focal point of the whole thing was the cross, I thought it was sort of interesting that they had just dug it up, you know, just in time to come out in that regard. You know, it's we will see as we go through that there were things that began in the pre-flood world that continued on through that were revived in the post-flood world, and that give a sort of a common thread of let's say pagan culture, regardless of what the particular mark or insignia that God set up was. Something was set up that served as a warning or was to provide a means of identity by where Cain was set apart. As I say, I rather think it to have been maybe initially some sort of a boundary marker. Now we find that Cain had his first son at some point after this, and he built a city that he named after his son. His son's name was Enoch, which means initiated. And then it goes through the genealogy of Cain's descendants. Now, at this point, I'd like to read you an excerpt from Josephus from Antiquities of the Jews. This is from Book 1, Chapter 2, that gives you a little bit of the tradition of the priesthood concerning Cain and Abel. Now, Cain, I don't think I mentioned earlier, Cain's name means get, you know, possession, something that is gotten or possessed. So little Get came along, and he followed the way of Get, as we're going to see. He was well named. We're told, speaking of Cain and Abel, Josephus writes, that now the two brothers were pleased with different courses of life. For Abel, the younger, was a lover of righteousness, and believing God was present in all his actions, he excelled in virtue. And his employment was that of a shepherd. Cain was not only very wicked in other respects, but was wholly intent upon getting. And he first contrived to plow the ground. He slew his brother on the occasion following, and they had resolved to sacrifice to God. Now Cain brought the fruits of the earth and of his husbandry, and Abel brought milk and the first fruits of his flocks. God was more delighted with the latter oblation. And he speaks of what Cain brought as being the invention of a covetous man and gotten by forcing the ground. Whence it was that Cain was very angry that Abel was preferred by God before him, and he slew his brother. Coming on a little further, when Cain had traveled over many countries, he with his wife built a city named Nod, which is a place so called, and there he settled, where also he had children. He did not accept his punishment in order to amendment, but to increase his wickedness. For he only aimed to procure everything that was for his own bodily pleasure, though it obliged him to be injurious to his neighbors. He augmented his household substance with much wealth by rapine and violence. He excited his acquaintance to procure pleasures and spoils by robbery, became a great leader of men into wicked courses. He was the author of Weights and Measures, and he changed the world into cunning craftiness. He first of all set boundaries about lands. He built a city and fortified it with walls, compelled his family to come together to it, and called that city Enoch, after the name of his eldest son, Enoch. And he goes on talking about the descendants of Cain, of Lamech, who was one of Cain's descendants, and of Lamech's children, Jabal and Jubal and Tubal. He speaks of Tubal, or Tubal-Cain, as he's called in Genesis. Tubal, one of his children by the other wife, exceeded all men in strength and was very expert and famous in martial performances. He procured what tended to the pleasures of the body by this method, and first of all invented the art of making brass. And so even while Adam was alive, it came to pass that the posterity of Cain became exceedingly wicked, everyone successively dying one after another more wicked than the former. They were intolerable in war, vehement in robberies, and if anyone were slow to murder people, yet he was bold in his profligate behavior by acting unjustly and doing injury for gain. So the point that we find is that this simply fits right in. Cain was the author of the civilization of the pre-flood world that resulted in the destruction of the pre-flood world. Now, there are a couple of other things that I want to share with you here at this point in terms of historical background. We read earlier the statement in Genesis 4:14, speaking of Cain, or what Cain said. He said, "You've driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from your face shall I be hid." Now, the word "shall I be hid" in the Hebrew is one word, satur. S-A-T-U-R would be the way that it would spell out. It's the origin of the name of the Latin divinity Saturn. This is the hidden one. That is the term that is used there. It's interesting. This is an excerpt from Lempriere's Classical Dictionary, speaking of of Saturn, identified with the Greek god Kronos, the son of Terra, which means the earth, the original mother in Greek mythology. We're told that that Saturn, or Kronos, was the author of civilization. That he was the one who first taught agriculture. Now, interestingly, this is a I have a page here that's from the Encyclopedia Britannica, laying out the major gods and goddesses of ancient Egypt. Now, the original parents, from whom everything else came, are identified here in Egyptian mythology as Geb, who was the and Nut, who was the mother of all the gods, and we find that their first son was Osiris, who is described as originally a fertility god, the giver of civilization, the inventor of agriculture, the son of the you know, the original parents. Osiris had a brother whose name, interestingly enough, was Seth, who was viewed as his great rival in Egyptian history. Osiris's descendant was Horus, who was the identified with the reigning kings of Egypt. Now, one of the things, we'll go into some of this a little more in next Bible study when we get into the story surrounding the Tower of Babel. But many of these names were titles that were introduced. Pagan religion was clearly introduced in the pre-flood world, and it was resurrected within a matter of a short time after the flood. The Tower of Babel was just slightly over 100 years after the flood, about 101 or 102 years, and certainly pagan religion was thriving by that time. But pagan religion undoubtedly began with Cain. He was the one who sought to lead people astray and was the giver of civilization, only it was worldly civilization. Now, in terms of history, I think the demarcation line of history would be that we would identify the old kingdom of Egypt with the pre-flood world and the period called the first intermediate period. That break in Egyptian history would be basically the time of the flood, and the middle kingdom then beginning right after the events of the Tower of Babel. There are a number of reasons, and there are things that then we would cross line up Mesopotamian history and others with that. I think the chronology fits the best that way, and it certainly, when you then began to look at Egyptian history from the standpoint of finding Cain and his family as the it's interesting, just the interplay in terms of mythology. I think most of the pagan mythology had its beginnings in the pre-flood world and got resurrected in the post-flood world. Other individuals came along and served to inherit those titles and to revive those things. But we find here in Genesis 4, the descendants of Cain, it talks about Lamech, and there is a sort of an enigmatic statement made, and Lamech was the other significant we had several generations between Cain and Lamech. Lamech was the significant descendant of Cain. I think in mythology the story of Lamech and Cain would be in the story of Zeus dethroning his father or ancestor Kronos, or Jupiter dethroning Saturn, this sort of thing that would these stories that have come down in pagan mythology that have certain roots in the ancient history. Lamech makes this statement in verse 23, this sort of enigmatic statement. I hear my voice, you wives of Lamech, hearken unto my speech. I have slain a man to my wounding, and a young man to my hurt, or a young man who hurt me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. Now, one of the interesting things as we go through chapter 5 and we have the genealogy of all of the descendants of Seth is that there is one of these descendants, Enoch by name, mentioned in Genesis 5:21, and on down for the next few verses, who stands out as distinct from all of the others of that line, and that is that Enoch's lifespan was less than half of the the closest one to him, almost a third of his the lifespan of his son Methuselah. Enoch lived 365 years, where all the others were living, 800-900. So, who was the young man that Lamech slew? We're not told exactly. There are traditions, Jewish traditions, which view Enoch as having been slain by Lamech. I think that is certainly a reasonable assumption. We're told that Enoch walked with God, and we're told that God took him. In the end of the book of Deuteronomy, we're told that when Moses died, God took him. God took his body and buried it, and nobody knew his burial place. Nobody was able to find it. What does it mean that God took him? Obviously, God removed him in some way. God either removed him in the way that he did Elijah, removed him when he was alive and moved him somewhere else and he died because all his days were 365 years, or Enoch died and God removed him in the same way that he did Moses. I think that his age is represents an aberration for all of the others in that line, and something obviously unusual took place. I rather lean to the Jewish tradition that when Lamech made the reference that I've slain a young man to my hurt. You know, Enoch was a preacher of righteousness. Cain and his family, Lamech at this time was the leader of the family of Cain, was Cain and Lamech were of the same generation in terms if you track it down from Adam. They were the same, they were contemporaries. And so we know that Enoch was a preacher of righteousness. The New Testament tells us that. We're told here that he was that he walked with God. We know Lamech didn't. And so you can figure that Lamech was the leader of the people who were doing the wrong things. And so, needless to say, it didn't probably take him very long to get upset at Enoch. So, it's one of these things that we look at and... there's certain tradition, there's certain speculation. We would maybe wish that God had given us more every detail. Someday we'll be able to get the complete story of all of these events. But the other reference here in terms of I have slain a man to my wounding, and then the reference of that if Cain is avenged, will be avenged seven times, I'd be avenged 77. If you look at the record of the record that is preserved in pagan mythology, then certainly the indication would be that perhaps Lamech was responsible for slaying Cain. I think that is likely from several standpoints that ultimately Cain reaped what he sowed, because Cain raised a family that was intent on getting and on violence, and this sort of thing increased, the population undoubtedly exploded rather rapidly. As you go through Genesis 5, it's obvious that people were reproducing for many years, for many, many decades. Methuselah died when he was, 969? Well, he didn't become, aged and decrepit when he was 69 and spend the next 900 years sort of hobbling on his walking stick. In fact, as you read the account in Genesis 5, you realize that aging simply did not go nearly so rapidly. Noah had children all the way up to as late as when he was 500. So, what number of children did some of these people have? And we don't know. But you start multiplying out, you don't have to start to too big of numbers, that things begin to reproduce or to multiply geometrically. You know, you realize initially there was plenty of land for people to spread out on. There was no shortage of anything. There were no disease epidemics. None of the things that serve naturally to inhibit population growth. They had the whole earth. And so very easily, within a matter of a few generations, you could be up to a matter of a few thousand people. You know, you figure if... Well, you just do a little figuring on let's say four generations. If one generation, first generation, produces enough children to give rise to 10 families, that's not an exceptional amount. The second generation does the same thing. Well, each of those 10 families then produce the equivalent of 10 families. Now, all of a sudden, you got 100. If the next one produces the same thing, then you got 1,000. By the fourth generation, you're looking at 10,000. You know, the fifth generation, you're looking at 100,000. I mean, you could be talking, within well under 200 years, a population of that neighborhood. And I just use that as a general figure, but it shows how quickly things can multiply up within a short, short period of time. The end of Genesis 4, we, of course, read about the birth of Seth, who was the replacement for Abel. Seth was the progenitor of the righteous line. And clearly, he stood out in exactly what way, we're not told. But from the beginning, Adam and Eve recognized him as Abel's replacement. And what all the factors were in that, we're not told. Now, chapter 5 gives us the genealogy, and it becomes the basis of, coming up with the chronology of the pre-flood world. Before I go on to that, let me point out one other thing back here in the family of Lamech. The his son Tubal-Cain, who was the originator of metalworking, brass and iron. Josephus says he was famous for his warlike dealings. He this is when the arms race began. It didn't start with India and Pakistan or the United States and Russia. Tubal-Cain was responsible for that. It's interesting in mythology, in Greek mythology, the originator of metalworking is named Vulcan. That's where we get our word volcano from. The V and the B in Hebrew are interchangeable. Depends on the word as to whether it's pronounced with a B or a V sound. Tubal-Cain is evidently the origin of the name Vulcan. Tubal-Cain, the prefix having been dropped, Balkane or Vulcan, who in Greek mythology was the son of Zeus, which would, of course, fit in with lining up Lamech in that way, as the when you put the story together from pagan mythology. What you find, I think, as we come on down to Genesis chapter 6, is the statement... before we go down that far, let's... We're coming on down here through Genesis 5 and 6. Well, let's notice at the end of chapter 4, the very last verse of chapter 4, which provides a little bit of a summary, 4:26. To Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then began men to call upon the name of the Lord. Now, there are a couple of different ways of translating this. The my margin gives the rendering, to call themselves by the name of the Lord. Other translations render it to preach or to publish in the name of the Lord. I think clearly there was a line of preachers of righteousness. Enos may very well have been the originator of writing. Later on in the Bible, in one particular case, the pen or the stylus that was used in writing was referred to as the pen of Enos. And, you know, why would it have taken his name? Well, perhaps he was the author of that. It appears the Hebrew calendar as we have it dates to the time of Enos. There is a particular benchmark date that is used. There's a particular benchmark date from which all dates in the Hebrew calendar are figured, and that benchmark date would take us back to the days of Enos. Perhaps he was, in some way connected with some of that. But a different aspect we come to here in Genesis chapter 6, we read about a group of people in Genesis 6 verse 2 called the sons of God, who saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all whom which they chose. Now, many people have speculated over the identity of these sons of God. The term sons of God is used several different ways in the Bible. It clearly is used to refer to Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It's used to refer to converted humans. Now are we the sons of God? It's used to refer in a physical sense to Adam back in the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. So the term was used that way. The term sons of God is used to refer to the angels. That's another way that it's used. Now, let's look at the problems with some of those definitions. Most of the commentaries will tend to say that the sons of God mentioned here in Genesis 6 verse 2 were angels. I think that is one of the most easily disproved statements, because for several reasons. The primary reason is angels don't marry. Christ said that. He said that, the children of the resurrection are like the angels in heaven. They neither marry nor are given in marriage. Angels were not created to reproduce. They don't marry. They weren't created to reproduce. The rebellion of Satan and his demons had been long before all of this. But if you just look at the context, Genesis 6:2, the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair. They took them wives of all which they chose. The Eternal said, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his day shall be 120 years. Coming on down, verse 5, God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth. Verse 6, it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth. Verse 7, the Lord said, "I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth." The point is that the focus is on man. The focus is not on angels. God didn't say, "I'm disgusted with these angels." The flood was going to have no effect or no punishment on the angels. This group called the sons of God were clearly the instigators. They saw and they took of what they chose. Clearly, they were the instigators. If they were angels, the following verses simply seemingly missed the point, because the whole emphasis in the aftermath of Genesis 6:2 is that God is upset with people and is going to punish mankind. The wickedness of man was great in the earth. Didn't say the wickedness of the angels was great. It repented the Lord he had made man. Didn't repent him that he had made the angels. So I think that the context clearly shows that he's talking about people. This group called the sons of God were clearly human beings, based on the fact of context and based on the fact that angels were never designed to reproduce and to reproduce with with human beings, or even, for that matter, to reproduce among themselves. Now, if they're human beings, what human beings are they? Well, they're certainly not converted human beings. They're individuals who did what God didn't want them to do. So their marriages were displeasing to God. So we're not looking at converted human beings. The term sons of God is not being used in the sense of referring to converted people. I think that if you look at the way the term was used in pagan mythology, I think that the reference here is to individuals who call themselves, who viewed themselves as the as sons of God. The context of the Genesis 4, 5, and 6 is that the family of Cain was the leader in terms of wickedness, and their ways spread out until ultimately everybody was copying and following the way of Cain, and finally you come to the point where violence filled the earth. And as we're told down here in Genesis 6, 11. The earth was corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. All flesh had corrupted his way, verse 12. So the way of Cain had spread and permeated. It's an ambiguous statement in Genesis 6:1, but it seems to me from the context that the term sons of God, and if you relate it back to Genesis 4:26, then began men to call themselves by the name of the Lord, that there were individuals. At some point along the line, Cain began teaching his followers, his descendants, pagan religion, and seeking to deify himself as Nimrod and Cush did after the flood. And I think the whole basis of the pagan religion that we read of and has been preserved, that Cain's and his family had been exiled and had been sent out to the land of Nod, had been separated. They, at some point along the line, now began to intermarry with others, with other branches of the human family, to break God's instructions, because the emphasis is they took them wives of all which they chose, clearly not concerned about what God's choice in the matter was. And term giants is used here in verse 4, though if you look up the term, there are two or three words for giant in the Old Testament, and this term does not necessarily mean giant in size. It can mean that, but the sense is individuals who are mighty or powerful, and there were just results. The whole wickedness began to just fill the earth, and the whole human family wound up being sort of coming into the caught up in the way of Cain and in the corrupt ways that followed. Cain is portrayed in pagan mythology as the giver of civilization, and in one way he was, if you're going to look at civilization, man's civilization cut off from God. Cain was the one who gave the direction that the human family seemed to be quick to follow. At this point, God intervened. It was apparent that things were off track, that things were to a point that God was going to put a stop to the way that things were headed. And we're told that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal. And Noah was a just man, and he was perfect in his generations. This expression, perfect in his generations, if you look it up, this word perfect is the word that is primarily used back in the book of Leviticus and Numbers to refer to say, physical purity of sacrificial offerings. I believe that Mr. Armstrong was correct in the way that he explained this in Mystery of the Ages and other things that he wrote, that the one statement, the fact that he was a just man, had to do with his, his spiritual state, and that he was perfect in his generations, or he was pure in his descent, is the other aspect of it, in terms of preserving the unmixed line of Seth, not mixed in with the line of Cain and others. It was God's intent to preserve these things down through into the post flood world, and Noah found grace. God looked upon the earth and it was corrupt, verse 12, and he told Noah that the end of all flesh has come before me. The earth is filled with violence through them, and I'll destroy them with the earth. Things were bad and getting worse. There was such violence leading to violence. Things were at a point where God was going to intervene. So he told Noah to make an ark through which humanity would be preserved. And not only humanity, but animals would be preserved. Now we find right here, God told Noah in Genesis 6:18, "With you will I establish my covenant, and you shall come into the ark, you and your sons, your wife, your sons' wives with you, and of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort." And getting more specific in chapter 7, God told Noah that he was to take clean beasts by sevens, Genesis 7, verse 2, and the unclean were to be taken by pairs. Now, various times over the years people have speculated about whether or not meat was eaten before the flood and things of this sort. Number one, Genesis 4 tells us that Abel was a keeper of sheep. Now, what did he keep sheep for? Just to look at them? He kept them because that was his livelihood. I mean, obviously, he ate them. He derived the wool, the milk, the meat, the offerings. When the offerings were made, the offerer normally partook of the altar. He partook of some of the offering. Clean and unclean meat was known before the flood. If you didn't have meat at all, then why would you have a distinction between clean and unclean? Why would Noah? It's introduced here as something that Noah already knew about. God didn't instruct him, as we find later on for the children of Israel. God told them, he said, "Now these are the clean beasts." Because they've been in Egypt, in the land of uncleanness, for decades and decades and decades. So God said, "All right, now here's what's clean and here's what's unclean." With Noah, there's no mention, "Well, Noah, now these are the clean beasts and you take them by seven." The statement is made in a way that presupposed that Noah knew the difference between clean and unclean. That went back to creation. This is another proof, that clean and unclean meats is not part of the Mosaic law. Noah knew the difference between clean and unclean meats. I've always said you can prove that Noah didn't eat, he didn't eat ham and bacon on the ark because he only had two pigs. So if he'd killed one of them, then there wouldn't have been any more pigs. I think it is good to note here that this matter of clean and unclean, Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. Now let's talk a little bit about the ark. Some have some have speculated that the flood was a local flood. it was localized, just in perhaps a little valley of the Euphrates of Mesopotamia, that it was a local flood. Now, there are several problems with that theory. We'll just look at what several of those problems are. One is there is virtually a universal story of the flood among virtually all people. The Egyptians have a flood story. The Babylonians have a flood story. There were various tribes of American Indians who had a flood story. People in India had a flood story. People in China had a flood story. You can go, you know, all over the world. Persians had a flood story. Their accounts of the flood, even in certain African traditions, in certain areas of the Pacific Islanders, the story. Of the flood and of the preservation of the human family on a boat. I mean, the details get garbled, but it basically all goes back to a man and his family being saved from a universal flood. Now, when you have something that is widespread, it clearly goes back to an original memory, to something that all of if the flood happened exactly as the Bible said, then all human beings on earth today are descended from the family of Noah. Therefore, the memory or the preservation of the memory of the flood, we would expect to be widespread, because that, if you trace it back far enough, is something that all humanity, the ancestors of all mankind, shared. Now, there are many other factors. For one thing, we're told that Noah was told to build a boat and bring the animals on board to protect them from the flood. If the flood was a local flood, why didn't God just tell him, climb the mountain and get on the other side? You certainly didn't need to protect all these animals. The animals would have beat it up to the top of the mountain over the other side. A third matter is we're told that in Genesis 7:19, waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the water prevail, and the mountains were covered. Now, you know, water seeks its own level. If you cover a mountain, if you get to the top of a mountain, what does the water do? It runs over the top and down to the valley on the other side. It's not going to cover. If it covers the top of the mountains, then that means you've got water, you know, all over everything. You can't have a mountain out here and the water covers the top of the mountain, but it doesn't cover everything else. If the water covers the top of the mountain, it spreads at that height out until it comes to something taller. So clearly the waters prevailed over all the earth, we're told. All the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail. So if it, we read later the ark came down on Mount Ararat. If you just do a little figure and get the height of Mount Ararat and figure if the water were that high, how far would it stretch? Well, it would stretch all over everything, because if it were high enough to cover that, it was high enough to cover, you know, everything around which was lower. So the flood was universal. Now, some people say, well, how could you have gotten all those animals on that boat? How could you put everything on the ark? There just wouldn't be enough room. Well, that's not so. Let's do a little figuring. We're told here the dimensions of the ark. Now, there are two different cubits. Well, there's more than two, but the cubit could vary from 18 inches. There's an 18-inch cubit all the way up to a 24-inch cubit. There were two or three different cubits. If the cubit mentioned in Genesis was the 18-inch cubit, the smallest cubit that is known, then the flood or the ark was a minimum of 450 feet long by 75 feet wide by 45 feet high. It was as tall as a four-story building. It was a big thing. Now, if it was the 24-inch cubit, then the ark was 600 feet long, 100 feet wide, and 60 feet high. Now, let's just figure with the smallest cubit, the 18-inch cubit. If you figure the capacity, the cubic feet, the ark would have had the capacity equal to 8 freight trains of 65 freight cars each, if you want to figure cubic capacity. So you just figure, you got eight freight trains lined up out here, and each of them have 65 freight cars. Now, you can pack a lot of cattle in 65 freight trains, or 8 freight trains of 65 cars, freight cars apiece. In fact, if we let's pick an average. Let's say that the average animal was the size of a sheep. Now you say, well, yeah, but there were elephants and there were giraffes and hippopotamus and rhinoceros and all these great big things. Well, there were some big animals, but there were a lot of little bitty ones. There were squirrels and rabbits and grasshoppers and all sorts of things. And most of the animals, you know, you can just about name all the big ones. By the time you finished a couple of hands, you're beginning to, get not a whole lot of those. Most of those are unclean, only two of them anyway. If you want to figure it out, taking the, we're told that what was represented on here were of every kind, Genesis kind, sort of, which would have been, that's not all the different varieties of dogs. That's, dogs. It's not all every imaginable breed of cattle. That would just be, these are the, let's say each species was represented. If you figure it up, you come up to about 35,000 animals. If you want to do some figuring, I can give you some material that'll give you the basis of this, but the number of animals on board the ark would have been no more than about 35,000. Now, you could take 35,000 sheep and put them on 2.5 of our before mentioned 8 freight trains. You could, filling up, putting them in freight cars. If you were shipping sheep, you wouldn't need but 2.5 of our 8 freight trains. That'd give you 5.5 freight trains empty. Plenty of space rattling around. There could have been food that was stored. Some of these animals, particularly some of the larger ones, maybe God put them in sleep. Maybe it was like they hibernated or something. You could pretty well count on the bears to do that. Maybe some of the others did as well. We're not told, but there would certainly have been plenty of room for animals, plenty of room for some foodstuffs, and any food that Noah and his family needed. They didn't need 5.5 freight trains of 65 cars each to haul their food for a year. You could, you could put all the wheat you could eat on in a part of one freight car, you'd have, far more than you'd be able to go through in a year's time. So the point being that what is described here for the ark and for the size of the ark is a very reasonable figure, which is just one more evidence that, this is the truth of God that is preserved, because how would somebody have known, thousands of years ago, how big a boat needed to be to do all that? They wouldn't have had any idea how many animals there were, or would have no way been able to come up with a reasonable estimate. So that's just one more thing. We're told that in Genesis 7:21, all flesh died that moved upon the earth. Now, we know the fish, and they didn't have to be on there. Noah didn't need room for the whales. The flesh died that moved upon the earth, the fowl and cattle and the beast, of every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth, and every man. And so we find that these creatures upon the earth were destroyed. Now, the flood ceased. The You know, the flood was a combination of the rain that came for 40 days, but that's not where all the water came from, because we're told that the fountains of the deep were broken up. And as we're told down here in Genesis 7:11, the 600th year of Noah's life, the second month, 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. Rain 40 days and 40 nights. Now, all of a sudden you had these, you know, it was like great big earthquakes, and the earth cracked open, and, you know, the waters just spewed up from down under the earth. Nobody knows how much water there is under the earth. Evidently, there's enough under there to do the job. And then when God got ready to drain it off, it's sort of like pulling the plug on a bathtub. You know, it just all of a sudden drained back down. And that solved the problem. One thing I would call your attention to here in Genesis 8, the ark rested in the seventh month, we're told, in verse 4. And the waters decreased. And they waited and waited until they could see the tops of the mountains. And he sent forth a raven. And in verse 8, he sent forth a dove to see if the waters were abated. The dove found no rest, and she returned to the ark. And Noah stayed 7 more days, verse 10, sent forth the dove, and the dove came in the evening, and she had an olive leaf. And so verse 12, stayed yet another 7 days, and he sent forth the dove and returned not again. Call your attention to these increments of 7 days. The weekly cycle was known. I think most likely this was the Sabbath. The Sabbath signifies rest. Noah sent forth the dove to see if the dove found rest. And then when she didn't, well, he waited 7 more days. You know, the family would have been gathered together. Noah would have had his family gathered for the Sabbath to worship God, and that would have been the logical time. This is clearly an indication that the weekly cycle was known, the 7-day week. We find that mentioned here, certainly an indication of the Sabbath. We find that, of course, the ark rested. Now, how long did Noah and his family spend in the ark? Well, as we begin to go through and to add it up, we find that it's actually a year and 17 days. Now, the way we know that is if we go back up here, when we're told up here in when Noah and his family went into the ark, that in Genesis chapter 7, Noah went into the ark, and he was told in verse 4, yet 7 days, and I'll cause it to rain upon the earth. And so Noah went in, verse 7, he and his sons. And verse 10, after 7 days, the waters of the flood came in the 600th year of Noah's life in the second month, 17th day. So, if they obviously went in on the 10th day, waited a week, and after 7 days, the flood began. And the flood began on the 17th day of the second month. As we come on down here to later in chapter 8, as to when they came out, verse 13, the 601st year, the first month, first day, the waters were dried up. The second month, the 27th day, the earth was dried, and God spoke to Noah, go forth out of the ark. So the second month, 27th day, the flood started on the second month, 17th day, and Noah and his family had That's a year and 10 days, and Noah and his family had already been there for a week, so that's a year and 17 days. That's a long time in the boat. He was glad to get his feet on dry land. You can bet your bottom dollar on that. He came out and he built an altar and sacrificed to God. The covenant, the rainbow was pointed out as the token of the covenant that God had made here, and so God blessed him here in chapter 9. We find that the rainbow is mentioned as the token in chapter 9, verse 13. God told Noah in chapter 9 that in verse 6 or verse 5, surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, in the image of God made he man. Be fruitful, multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth, and multiply therein. So God instructed Noah that from henceforth, if someone committed murder, they were to be executed. The story of the pre-flood world shows what happens when that doesn't happen. Violence fills the earth. And so God instructed Noah that was not to be the case. We come on down to the three sons of Noah mentioned down here, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, I would just call your attention to the curse of Canaan. And some have puzzled about that. I think missing the point that Noah cursed Canaan because Canaan was the one who performed this perversion. Now, that's not apparent at first glance when you read the story, but if you read it carefully, we find in verse 18, the sons of Noah that went forth out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. So our attention is called to Canaan. And we're told that Ham saw something, got his brothers, but when Noah awoke from his wine, verse 24, he knew what his younger son had done and said, cursed be Canaan. Now, who's the younger son? Well, in every genealogy that you have listed, Ham is always listed as the middle son. Shem is listed first in terms of priority, though Genesis 10 tells us that actually Japheth was the elder. But Ham is always mentioned as the middle son. But we are told that of Ham's children, Canaan was Ham's youngest child. That's what we're Genesis 10:6, the sons of Ham, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Canaan was Ham's youngest son. Ham was Noah's middle son. The term his in verse 24 refers back up here to verse 22 to Ham. Ham is the one who saw this and went and got his brothers. It keeps mentioning Ham, the father of Canaan. The emphasis that Canaan had engaged in some sort of a perversion, and that's why Noah put the curse on him. There was a curse that came as a result of these of his actions, and old sins cast long shadows. Canaan's actions impacted himself. It impacted his family, his descendants, the kind of family structure they were given, and the whole approach. And there was a curse that was brought about. Now, we might just let me look here just to comment briefly on anything I mentioned. A little more about Tubal-Cain. Jubal was the one we're told that Jubal was was not the inventor of music. One translation brings it out, and I think when you get the picture of the whole family of Cain, as one translation brings it out, Jubal was the first to profane the harp. Jubal undoubtedly misused music in the way that the rest of the family misused other things. Methuselah's name meant the sense of his name is when he dies it will go forth. Methuselah died in the year of the flood, and it's interesting if that you know, he was the oldest man mentioned in the Bible, lived longer than anyone else, and we're told that Enoch prophesied back. Jude tells us Enoch prophesied of these things, that there were prophecies of the of God's judgment of the flood, and you know, people didn't think it was ever going to come, but it did, and Methuselah didn't live forever. He died. One thing we also might look at is the statement some have taken here concerning food. The in Genesis 9, verse 10, with every living creature. Okay, is it? Comes in Genesis 9:3, every moving thing that lives shall be meat for you, food for you, even as the green herb have I given you all things. Now I think it very likely that during the year, slightly over a year of the flood, that Noah and his family did eat grain and whatever, you know, foodstuffs like that, vegetables and things that were stored on the ark, because they only had a very small number of animals on the on the ark. But we've seen evidence that they were eating meat prior to the flood. God, I think, is here giving him permission once again, and the statement, even as the green herb have I given you all things. Now, in terms of clean and unclean meat, does that mean that now Noah was free to eat, buzzards and bats and every sort of thing? No, he says, I'm giving you the animal flesh the same as you have the green herbs. Well, you know, the green herbs that aren't fit to eat. You don't go out and have, you know, pick poison ivy and have poison ivy salad. It's poison. And there's animal flesh that's poison. Now, some of it doesn't work as quickly, but the point is, we eat animal flesh the same way we eat vegetation. We eat what's good for us. We eat what's what is appropriate, what's clean. God had, I think, the sense of it is that there was a temporary time of slightly over a year during which Noah and his family would not have eaten meat, and now God is telling them that they have permission to do so again, in the same way that they've been free to eat the vegetation. We are pretty well out of time. Next Bible study, we can perhaps open up for even come back and pick up any questions on this. I don't want to run us too far over. There's so much packed into such a very few chapters here. But anyway, we've gotten a little bit of flavor of the pre-flood world. I have study questions on Genesis 10 and 11. We're going to cover just a short time, just a couple of chapters next time. So we'll see if we are able to get through those. And so with that, we'll be concluded this evening, and I'll pass out questions for next time.